The psyche is real. Jung wrote in his book, Answer to Job, these words. What most people overlook or seem unable to understand is the fact that I regard the psyche as real. Unquote. These words are the foundation of Jung's work. And they are the core of everything that I think can legitimately be called Jung's psychology. The psyche is real. You know, many of us have some sense of this psychic reality, but it's the hardest thing in the world to put into words or to meaningfully communicate to another. It's hard to declare it in our modern world. And it was hard for Jung. And he knew when he said that, he was not understood. The depth of his affirmation is still very seldom comprehended. Near the end of his life, in the last few years of his life, Jung wrote a private letter, and this is what he said. Quote, I had to understand that I was unable to make the people see what I am after. I am practically alone. There are a few who understand this and that, but almost nobody sees the whole. I have failed in my foremost task, to open people's eyes to the fact that man has a soul and there is a buried treasure in the field, and that our religion and philosophy are in lamentable state. End quote. During the time Jung wrote that, he was actually very deeply depressed. He was in despair near the end of his life that he had indeed failed. And I remember reading those words many years ago, and I remember some 25 years ago when I visited Jung's grave in Zurich, a sense that he had not failed, but that his message had to be conveyed. The whole, not the this or the that, but the whole of what he was after. And some 25 years ago, I decided that's really what I had to work at, to try to help in my own small, humble way. The soul, the psyche, is real. Women and men have a soul. And in it, there is a treasure. You know, the phrase sounds like religion, like a proclamation of faith, an affirmation of some sort of spiritualistic belief, a belief taken too far from the facts of our modern life. How does anyone know such a thing? What gives anyone the right to say such things? How dare Dr. Jung make such a declaration? Well, first I would say, understand that this is not a proclamation of faith or of belief on Jung's part. It is not a metaphysical or a theoretical statement. It is simply an avowal rendered from his encounter with his evidence. Call that empirical, if you will. Jung personally encountered the reality of the psyche, or at least so it seemed to him. And So it seems to me. He then spent decades attempting to point at other human affirmations of this experience as they were established by his clinical experiences, and even more importantly, as they are found in the records of our kind, of our humanity. Over many years, he noted that the spirit of our time was not attuned to such affirmations, and that he was not understood. His response really began at the very beginning, in 1914, when he declared that the spirit of our times is actually pathological. It's unbalanced. It is a disease, a morbid state of mind. A morbid state of mind that has split nature in half, and discarded half. And he felt that history gave evidence to this diagnosis. We had a conference in southern Utah recently on eco-psychology, and there was a concept that came up in the discussions of what was called solastalgia, the sense of loss of an ecological environment that one has known. And often one's sense, one's set point of what one has known is where you grew up as a younger person. And as years pass, you go back and you see the change and you feel a nostalgia, a loss for what's gone. But the problem is this sense of loss is reset with every generation. We only know what we have lost in our lifetime, what we have seen gone in our lifetime. And it occurred to me that really, in a way, when Jung talks about history as a key to understanding the psyche, he's talking much about this concept. We don't know what we've lost because we don't know what we had, what we once felt, what we once knew, what we once experienced in terms of the psyche. Our age has become so distant from that primary fact of affirmation, of time immemorial, of human experience, onward and backward to our beginnings, to the beginnings of this thing we call our nature. And so he said, there can be no psychology, understanding, critical psychology, without history, without a sense of what it is, what it has been, and perhaps what it will be to be human. In 1931, Jung wrote an essay titled The Basic Postulates of Analytical Psychology. And in this he said, and I quote, "It would all be so much simpler if we could only deny the existence of the psyche. But here we are, with our immediate experience of something that is, something that has taken root in the midst of our measurable, ponderable, three-dimensional reality that differs bafflingly from this in every respect and in all its parts, and yet reflects it." The psyche may be regarded as a mathematical point, and at the same time as a universe of fixed stars. It is a small wonder, then, if to the unsophisticated mind such a paradoxical being borders on the divine. If it occupies no space, it has no body. Bodies die, but can something invisible and incorporeal disappear? What is more, life and psyche existed for me before I could say, I. And when this I disappears, as in sleep or unconsciousness, life and psyche still go on. As our observation of other people and our own dreams informs us. Why should the simple mind deny, in the face of such experiences, that the soul lives in a realm beyond the body? I must admit that I can see as little nonsense in this so-called superstition as in the findings of research regarding heredity and the basic instincts. End quote. Psyche is not purely physical, nor an epiphenomenon of the brain and its processes. He said, the psyche may be regarded as a mathematical point and at the same time as a universe of fixed stars. Human nature mysteriously encounters a duality in its own nature. In our own nature, we discover two things naturally wed together in the singularity of our life. Nature, human nature. Our perceptive abilities rest in our awakened consciousness and in a mysterious realm that in the last century we have come to call the unconscious. The depths of the psyche and the unconscious background to consciousness can, when encountered, seem dark and hateful, full of shadows and brimming with our personal wounds. Brimming with our personal wounds. But beyond these shadows, even deeper, within, Jung affirms there is also a guiding light. In 1928, in an essay entitled The Modern Spiritual Problem, Jung explained, quote, the psychic depths are nature, and nature is creative life. The psychic depths are nature, and nature is creative life. He continues explaining the difficulty of meeting psychic depths. Quote, at first we cannot see beyond the path that leads downward to dark and hateful things. But no light or beauty will ever come from the man who cannot bear this sight. Light is always born of darkness. Light is always born of darkness. Jung further asserts that consciousness is born from the unconscious matrix. What we label the unconscious is a primeval foundation of reality, the mother of life, if you will. In 1937, when he presented the Terry Lectures at Yale University, he took the assertion even further, saying, quote, not only does the psyche exist, it is existence itself. End quote. All our enduring myths, our dreams, our religious symbols, and all the stories we tell about our humanity and our history, all are imaginatively children of the psyche, at least in Jung's view. All emerging from the creative womb we call the unconscious. Our human history is a story told by the psyche. The unconscious inner world is not static. It's alive. It has purpose and intention, prospective intention. And Jung suggested perhaps it even has its own veiled form of interior consciousness. We do not possess or create the psyche. It is not an object of our subjectivity. Better, we are its objects and its manifestation in time. Why would an intelligent, modern man make such strange statements? As Dr. Edward Ettinger pointed out many years ago, when you begin to understand the answer to that question, you will have begun to understand something about Dr. C.G. Jung. And I believe at this point in history that comprehension will include an understanding of what Jung experienced between 1913 and 1920, as recorded in Liber Novus, in the Red Book. In fact, I think I would now say that absent Liber Novus, absent an encounter with Liber Novus, it is really nearly impossible to understand why anyone would say such strange things, claiming an experiential basis underlying their affirmation. Liber Novus was the bedrock and foundation of his life work, of Jung's work. It was, as he said, the numinous beginning, which contained everything. So in our seminar last year, I attempted to point you through the doorway of Liber Novus, of that strange book, and let you confront Jung's experience, his raw experience, and thereby perhaps understand its transformative effect upon him, and why he might say such strange things. I'm well aware that Liber Novus is a difficult task. In one way or another, I've been struggling with it and the things around it for a couple decades of my life, and sometimes I've been crawling on my knees through it. It is difficult to grasp. But let me put it simply again. Just put it this way. And I know how strange it sounds. Beginning in 1913, Jung undertook one of the most extraordinary odysseys or voyages of discovery in human history, in human record. He found a passage to vision and walked through. And he brought back a record of the discoveries. This is the history, the documentary record, the fictive fact behind Liber Novus. And as Jung is quoted in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, his biographical memoir, it appears to be a risky experiment or a questionable adventure to entrust oneself to the uncertain path that leads into the depths of the unconscious. The uncertain paths that lead into the depth of the unconscious. That is what he had done. It is considered the path of error, of equivocation, and misunderstanding. I am reminded of Goethe's words, "Now let me dare to open wide the gate, past which men's steps have ever flinching trod." This journey, he goes on to say, it is a link in the Ara Catena, the golden chain, which has existed from the beginnings of philosophical alchemy and Gnosticism down to Nietzsche's Zarathustra. Unpopular, ambiguous, and dangerous, it is a voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. He said it's a link in the Aria Catena. That means the golden chain. It's a term that comes from Hermetic literature. Jung uses it here without explication, but the concept of this golden chain was that at every time in the history of humanity, there had been individuals who stood between, above and below, who in some fashion were in communication with deeper realities as well as more visible realities. And these people, by providing this link between the worlds, inner and outer, the two worlds in which we live, were a power of life and memory in history. And Jung really felt that what had happened to him put him in that sort of a role, as a link in this chain of human consciousness. So, what were his conclusions in Liber Novus? He went through this experience, this visionary experience we talked to about, pointed to, throughout last year. And based upon experience with lots of people who have attempted to read Liber Novus, I know that this is not an easy book to get through. People don't easily draw some of this material out independently. They can't get to the fact of what he was doing. So what were his conclusions? I went through some of these at the end of last year, but let me just review them. The first, I think, critical one, were his words, and I've repeated these many times, these words, that man lives in two worlds, humankind. Humans live in two worlds. The inner realm, which we call the psychic realm or the unconscious, is no less real and no less infinite, no less real and no less infinite than the outer cosmos. But in accord with the spirit of this time, we look only outward into time and into space, and we are blinded by the fiery majesty of the cosmos. To become aware of the inner, the timeless, or unconscious realm, we must give it our attention. We must turn to the depths, open ourselves to the spirit of the depths, to the light of an inner sun. And getting through that light involves, as Jung said earlier, as I quoted, passage through a good deal of darkness, our own darkness. Vision, imagination, and dreams are, in Jung's view, doorways to the inner world. But Jung said the royal passage was vision. And that is the doorway through which he passed in Liber Novus. Now the second thing that he discovered or encountered in this journey was that the inner infinite is a realm of numinous powers, numinous. That's a word that Jung really resurrected from ancient languages. Godlike. Godlike powers. That's what that means. Direct experience of this realm has the soulful savor of divinity, of otherness, but in both bright and dark qualities. Bright and dark qualities. In it we meet a plurality of figures, autonomous figures. And Jung claimed that from time immemorial, humans have accessed such experiences. And they have associated those experiences with the mystery of gods and demons, spiritual powers. Only when met experientially can this be known. It is not a concept, it is not an object of belief, but a fact of human perceptive experience. And to this sense of there being an inner, infinite realm of numinous powers, I would add a second motive here, that sometimes something out of this presents itself as a messenger, a guide, a guru, a counselor. And Jung had met that figure whom he called Philemon in one form. And that's really weird, isn't it? Really strange. That a man is walking in his garden with a imaginative emanation that is teaching. But that is how he felt it. And this figure became autonomous to him. Why would the man say such strange things? because the man was strange. Things happened. Confronting this inner realm, this psychic realm, we perceive our personhood deposed of its sovereignty. Ego discovers it is not the ruler of its own kingdom, or the sole master of its house. And you know, this is very much the idea of empowerment, ego empowerment. We want to be in control. Hold on to the many strings and puzzle pieces of our lives. When we come in contact with this deeper reality, the sense that we are master of the house dissolves. In fact, I think most of us on a day-by-day basis are confronted with the fact that we are not the master of our houses. I was talking to my son recently, and he quoted back to me something I had said to him when I was advising him to make a certain plan. He says, you know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Yeah, that's what I told him. So, and that is deposing. But as we encounter the deeper psychic realities, which have this sense of God-like quality, we do find that we and our plans, our power, is actually subjugated to something greater. And that can be a shattering experience. It can be deflating. It can be crushing. However, if one survives the experience, and that I accept as a big if, it can lead to a vast expansion of consciousness and a new perspective on the nature of life and of self. In sum, we finally know what it is to be human. What it is to be human. Next, as experienced and discriminated, the inner world had dualistic qualities. Qualities both light and dark. Evil dwells there in us. But there too we meet supernal light. It is heaven and it is hell. And this is the great paradox. Consciousness confronts duality. One realm was reached in Jung's experience by ascent, another by descent. In ancient myth, even Christ had to harrow hell before he could ascend to heaven. This is an act of redemption. Next, for Jung himself, a child of Western Christian culture, the journey involved intense confrontation with the image of Christ. Jung's visions inexorably led Jung toward confrontation with the imitatio Christi, the Latin term meaning the imitation of Christ. And this became a leitmotif throughout Libertas. Jung surveys what it means to be not just a Christian believer, but a Christ, a full and conscious participant in the act of redemption. The conjoining of the psychic opposites brings integration of consciousness, wholeness, and human transformation. And this is what he called individuation. Becoming whole, undivided, individuum. And that's what individuum means. It doesn't mean being an individual, it means being undividable, indivisible, complete. Throughout Liber Novus, Jung attempts to come to terms with what has been rejected, with the opposite, the adversary, the missing half that brings wholeness and heals the wound of one-sided consciousness. And he explains, quote, "You begin to have a presentiment of the whole when you embrace your opposite principle, since the whole belongs to both principles, which grow from one root." Which grow from one root, from the very fact of our nature, one root. In Liber Novus, this unification of opposites, which grows from one root, has not only personal developmental implications, but also profound soteriological, a profound soteriological or saving function. Next, I would add that the language of the psychic world is symbolic. It speaks in images. Symbol alone expresses this melding of inner and outer, of hot and cold, of sense and nonsense. And symbol alone conveys the supreme meaning, the summation, perception, that ultimately lies beyond words. And finally, human history is the story of interaction with this interior psychic wellspring of all consciousness. Our great myths and God stories are reflections of encounters with experiences of profound otherness. This fact of human experience stands apart from metaphysical speculation or conceptualization. It is not metaphysics. It is not theology. It is the first fire at the forge, the first forming fact. All theologies and metaphysical statements are secondary constructs, mere speculations about the sparks scattering from this forge of primal human experience. Okay. Those are some of the conclusions that Jung brought out of this experience with Liber Novus, things that he had actually formed by about 1919, 1920. I started out this series of lectures talking about psychological types, and I talked practically about some of those issues within Jung's psychological types and their application to our own lives. But psychological types actually went much deeper. When Jung wrote Psychological Types in 1919, he was still hard at work on Liber Novus, on the transcription of Liber Novus into the Red Book. Remember, he had the manuscripts done. Now he was writing it out. And as he was writing it out, he was going through an entire new layer of contemplation, adding the images, working on these images. They were not part of the original. They were constructed in his relationship to the text as he did the art. By the end of 1919, about the time he finished Psychological Types, and Psychological Types was published in 1921, it takes a year or so to get things into press, he had finished 123 pages of the Red Book, including the additional first seven parchment folio sheets that he'd done in 1915. This amounts to about three-quarters of everything that he would finally transcribe into Liber Novus. From about this point on, his transcription slowed down and it really stopped in 1930. Psychological Types was Jung's first attempt at a psychological recension of the new knowledge that was contained in his new book. And in this work, Jung is commenting on Liber Novus in a veiled form, particularly in chapters 2 and most importantly, chapter 5 of Psychological Types. And I sent you a link to the book, and I know it's a difficult book to read. As I read through it again this fall, I realized, holy shit, this is not easy reading. And I prepared, just for my own study, a 45-page recension of chapter 5. It's 160 pages long. And I went through and I commented, and I tried to pull out the important passages that indicate where Jung is going in his work at this point. And if any of you, some of you asked me for that, if any of you want it, I'll be glad to send you the email if you want to torture yourself and try to understand chapter 5 of Psychological Types. A few people have told me it's useful, including people who have read it for 20 years. So, he is making commentary in this work on his experience of vision and of creative fantasy, and the opposites of inner and outer reality. He is giving form to conclusions he has drawn from his experiences. But most importantly, he's working towards a hermeneutic. An interpretive method. An interpretive approach to his experience. But now using the language of psychology. And it can be conjectured that actually Psychological Types was an effort preparatory to publication of Liber Novus, an advanced statement of some sort to make Liber Novus comprehensible, should it ever be published. And when he's writing Psychological Types, he cannot use Liber Novus in his, he cannot employ his own poetic, creative, or imaginative text in as a source for his developing psychology, or add this to his commentary presented in Psychological Types. And of course, there are several obvious reasons for this. Principal among them, Liber Novus was unpublished. It was private. And it might never be published. But more, Jung perceived that if the Red Book were disclosed without some preparation, some preceding work preparatory to its publication, explaining what he had experienced, it would be incomprehensible. At least to readers of his own time. And I think now, almost 100 years after its construction, it remains incomprehensible to many people. One really has to go through all of this stuff that Jung did to understand what happened in Liber Novus. And then, after encountering Liber Novus, my impression is you have to go back and read him again. It's a circular process, because the book Liber Novus is the source of much of all of that Jung did. But once you read Liber Novus, you have to go back and look at all of Jung did to understand how it came from Liber Novus. It's this big circle which I've been personally going through for the last 3 years. And believe me, it gets very interesting, at least for weird people like me. In 1919, Jung understands the road ahead of him and the work that awaits him. He must begin preparing a hermeneutics of his vision, an interpretive method to what had happened to him in Liber Novus. And he must create a method to his madness and a psychology that met the depths of the psyche he now has experienced. To do that, he must explain the nature of vision and creative imagination. So how is creative imagination understood? How is it rendered to form? How do prior historical records of visionary experience, what he might call historical encounters with the voice of the depths, reflect and amplify things Jung had met in his own visions and creative fantasy, as recorded in Liber Novus? In Psychological Types, which Jung wrote just 6 years after this whole process had burst forward on him, Jung begins his attempt to extensively explain the nature of a collective unconscious. This is really the first time Jung is talking about a collective unconscious in 1919. He has entered this collective level of consciousness during the prior 6 years, or so he supposes. And when I say so he supposes, I accept that to a lot of people, he was mad. It was psychosis. He was in a disassociative state. I accept that as a critique. But I think people who make that critique have not spent enough time with people in psychosis and disassociative states, or they have not spent enough time with Dr. Jung. Because when you have spent time with people lost in psychosis and disassociative states, you'll know what that's like. And when you've met Dr. Jung and what he was going through, you'll see that there is no conjunction. There is no crossover in the nature of the experience. That is the strangest thing. And I've really looked at this closely. And I have, in my life, spent a lot of time with people who are psychotic or in disassociative states, shall we say. So, envision, or call it creative imagination if you will, it works the same. It's the same thing. Jung had met timeless images and personified figures that spoke and acted and interacted with autonomy. By his analysis, they were not objects of his creation, but manifestations of a collective psyche, a collective psychic heritage. Jung now has a task of explaining his experience, interpreting it, and finding a way of explaining it. And the first part of this task was really quite obvious. If a collective psyche exists, if there is a collective psychic heritage, others must have met similar images and characters across history. And they must have done so in multiple cultural contexts. So where is the evidence of this experience? Where is the evidence? And for this, Jung had to turn to the historical record, to the human record. Jung attempts to illustrate the nature of psychic contents he has encountered by giving examples of other creative visionary works, ultimately reaching back across 2,000 years of human history. What Jung has met in the past 5 years transcends his personality. It's transpersonal. And he makes this clear in his discussion of creative vision in Psychological Types. In touching the collective levels of the unconscious, he knows that he has moved beyond himself. And so in Psychological Types, he asserts that the great creative artists and poets do move beyond themselves. They do move beyond themselves. Beyond the range of personal capacity. And that they reach this collective depth of human consciousness. And in Psychological Types, he's brought out various authors of recent literature as his witnesses, his evidence. And he starts by talking about Spittler, whose work, Prometheus and Epimetheus, he's been analyzing in Psychological Types. And he says, quote, "In a poet of modest capacity, we may assume that the pinnacle of his work does not transcend his personal joys, sorrows, and aspirations." In the poet of modest capacity, his work does not transcend his personal joys, sorrows, and aspirations. But Spittler's work, which he's been analyzing here in Psychological Types, but Spittler's work entirely transcends his personal destiny. For this reason, his solution of the problem is not an isolated one. Then he goes on to speak of other recent figures who he's been talking about Schopenhauer and about Nietzsche. And he says, quote, "Schopenhauer's work by far transcends his personality. It voices what was obscurely thought and felt by many thousands. Similarly with Nietzsche, his Zarathustra in particular brings to light the contents of the collective unconscious of our time. And in him we find the same distinguishing features." Then Jung continues explaining where creative imaginative efforts find their source, claiming it is part of the collective psychic heritage of humankind, of a time. And here again I state, the collective unconscious repository of images is a fact Jung is asserting based upon his own experience over the last 5 years. You just have to nail this one in to thought. And then he continues. But what creative minds bring out of the collective unconscious also actually exists there, and sooner or later must make its appearance in collective psychology. What creative minds bring out of the collective unconscious actually exists there. You see, he's given a sense of ontological reality to the collective unconscious. We cannot therefore afford to be indifferent to the poets, since in their principal works and deepest inspirations, they create from the depths of the collective unconscious, voicing aloud what others only dream. And hear those words again. But what creative minds bring up out of the collective unconscious also actually exists. The realm of the psyche is real, you see. It actually exists. Or so says Dr. Jung. So he proclaims with his life's work. However, current culture does not meet the creative artist in such profound terms. And Jung goes on to explain, quote, but though they, the creative artists, proclaim it aloud, they fashion only a symbol in which they take aesthetic pleasure, without any consciousness of its true meaning. End quote. And this is the predominant orientation of our culture, and of an artist within culture. The creative act is limited to aesthetic pleasure, without any consciousness of its true meaning. You know, sometimes you'll read a poem that's beautiful, and yet in that reading, something in it will touch something so much deeper in you that responds, that signals truth. It touches a reality in you. Our culture is very much cinematic now. We have lots of movies that we watch. And some of them are just blatant entertainment, noise, and action. And at some time in a scene or in an image brought to you by the artist, something will touch you. And it's not just aesthetic pleasure. Something is coming out of it that reaches a deeper level of meaning. Jung actually sent Carl Spittler, the poet who did this work, Epimetheus and Prometheus, a copy of Psychological Types to read after he had done this huge psychological analysis of the deeper meanings of the work. And Spittler never wrote him back, but shortly after he received the book, he gave a lecture that was quoted to Jung, in which he said to his audience that my poem means nothing more than tra-li-da-di-li-da. It has no meaning. That was what Jung was talking about. This thing comes out of the unconscious, and it is simply the creative act. The fact that it is a statement from something deeper is neglected. Its meanings, its ethical power, is not integrated. This is the predominant orientation of our culture. The creative act is delimited to aesthetic pleasure, and there is no consciousness of meaning. Meaning is a statement of collective levels of the psyche. And this was the problem Jung himself was confronting when he went through the Red Book process. You'll remember that when he was doing this, the question came to him. In fact, a figure, a voice came to him saying, this is art. And his response was, this is more than art. It is not just art. I am not just an artist. And the voice would come back to him, but you are. This is art. Art. Jung refused to aestheticize what had happened to him in the prior years. It was not just poetry. It was not art. And he would not fall into that cultural trap. And so in Psychological Types, he's talking about what's happened. He is searching for a new hermeneutic, a new way of interpreting creative vision itself. And that's what he's doing here. He continues, "The more deeply the vision of the creative mind penetrates, the stranger it becomes to mankind in the masses." The more deeply the vision of the creative mind penetrates, the stranger it becomes to mankind in the masses. And the greater is the resistance to the man who in any way stands out from the mass. The mass does not understand him. Well, in 1919, when Jung wrote those words in Psychological Types, he was talking about himself. He was talking about what he knew he'd been through, of what he had been, of where he had been. The deeper the vision penetrates, the stranger it becomes to mankind in the masses. I think that pretty well sums up what most people encounter with Libra Novus. Next, he comments on his own destiny, occultly. I mean, he's in veiled terms, but he's speaking about himself in these paragraphs. His own understanding of himself and his perception that Libra Novus would not be understood at his time in cultural history. He speaks here of the creative visionary poet, certainly including himself among them, and I quote, "When the visionary's insight into the collective unconscious reaches a depth where its content can no longer be grasped in any conscious form of expression, it is difficult to decide whether it is a morbid product," and the word morbid means diseased, "whether it is a morbid product or whether it is incomprehensible because of its extraordinary profundity." In other words, you can't understand it either because it's sick or it's just too deep. "The fame of these creators, if it ever arrives at all, is posthumous and often delayed for several centuries." And that's really how Jung sees himself. No one's going to understand this in my life. And it may not be understood for centuries after I'm dead. He's right. He was right. The question is it just morbid? Is it just pathology? As he said, it might be judged. Or is it that the profundity extends beyond our collective ability of understanding at this cultural moment? Judgments vary. I've made my judgment. Others will make theirs. So, Dr. C.G. Jung recognized that what he had experienced in the last 6 years was not personal, nor was it to be rendered for aesthetic pleasure. What he had experienced, integrally entwined and amplified by his hermeneutic, by his interpretive effort of the event, was epical. Epical. And as he said, "The fame of these creators, if it ever arrives, is posthumous and often delayed for several centuries." He went on this theme, and I'll just finish off this section with these statements. Because this is important. You see, the guy understood both what he had been through and the difficulty of sharing what he'd been through. And I've been talking about the stuff that Jung's done, the Red Book now, and I realize people don't get it. At the end of his life, he said, "I'm not understood. I know that. I know that." So how do you try to get it across? How do you get it across? He understood the difficulty. And much of his work, subsequent to Liber Novus, is an attempt to somehow lead people slowly back into the process, into the fact, to try to understand this treasure that he says, this treasure that exists within the soul, the reality of the psyche. In 1922, Jung presented a paper on what he called the relation of analytical psychology to poetic works. And he differentiated two types of work. Those that sprang entirely from the author's intentions, and a much more profound group, where the work autonomously seized the author. Autonomously seized. In other words, it came down and just grabbed him and carried him away. And he felt this was really true of people like Goethe and Nietzsche. And he sure knew it was true of Dr. Jung in 1914. Two types of work. The first group of works drew from the personal and conscious of the author, personal and conscious, while the second group erupted from the collective unconscious. In these works, these second works, the creative process represented unconscious activation of archetypal images, of collective images. And the archetypal images release a voice that is stronger than one's own. And I think, you know, works of this type, these are the ones that endure across the centuries, that keep speaking across the ages. How many such works are there in our age? You know, how many books are published a year in America? How many of those books will be read in 200 years? In 300 years. Think about it. How many books in your own personal library will anyone flip through, or many people flip through, 300 years from today? If you know of such a work, if you sense it, know that that's it. That's probably one of those works where the author has been seized by something more than himself or herself and brought out images from a collective level. And so, Jung says of these, whoever speaks in primordial images speaks with a thousand voices. He enthralls and overpowers. He transmutes our personal destiny into the destiny of mankind and evokes in us all those beneficent forces that ever and anon have enabled humanity to find a refuge from every peril and to outlive the longest night. These are the things that sustain us, that help us find refuge and survive the perils. And how is that? Because they remind us of the deepest fact of what it is to be human, wholly human. And obviously, Jung sees his own work, Liber Novus, in these terms. And you know, I would say that this is a great inflation. You could see it that way. I mean, megalomaniacal thoughts. You could see it that way. Except, he never showed it. He never published it. He made no plans for its publication, even after his death, and he spent 45 years trying to explain. He took the hard road on this one, babe. 10 years later, in 1930, Jung spoke to this issue again, commenting on signal imaginative creations across the ages. Jung states that great imaginative art, and I quote, draws its strength from the life of mankind, and we completely miss its meaning if we try to derive it from personal factors. Whenever the collective unconscious becomes a living experience and is brought to bear upon the conscious outlook of an age, this event is a creative act which is of importance to a whole epoch. This event is a creative act which is of importance to a whole epoch. A work of art is produced that may truthfully be called a message to generations of men. This is affected by the collective unconscious when a poet or seer lends expression to the unspoken desire of the times and shows the way by word or deed to its fulfillment. Unquote. And again, with these words, Jung is speaking in kind of his own hidden book, Liber Novus. The primary translation to word of vision, a multifaceted layering of word and image, and image and word, reaching back and forward in time, a creative act which is of importance for a whole epoch, a message to generations of men. Dr. Sonu Shamdasani explained in his most recent book, a book called C.G. Jung, A Biography in Books, and this is a marvelous book. If any of you are looking for something on Jung, it's an incredible book. Dr. Shamdasani says, quote, "The artist who produces such works educates the spirit of the age and made up for the one-sidedness of the present. Implicitly, Jung was claiming that great art was that which stemmed from the collective unconscious. Though Liber Novus was replete with compensatory primordial images, rather than presented as his own material art, Jung sought to mine it for insights into the psychology of creative works in general." And then, this is the important phrase. "Jung was in effect proposing a new theory of creativity and literary inspiration. A great artist was like a medium who gave voice and fitting expression to the primordial images." And those words, those are really key words. And I think in some ways this is the way Jung's going to be understood in years to come. He said Jung was in effect proposing a new theory of creative and literary inspiration. He was suggesting that there is some deeper level, and that the artist is somehow becoming a link in that golden chain. He's reaching, or she is reaching, those deeper levels and bringing things up that are transpersonal. And that this is what great art is. This artist is a medium who gave voice and expression to primordial images. So Jung fully understands the challenge he faces in revealing and explaining what has happened to him. The task is conjoined to a new hermeneutic, a new interpretive art, a new way of seeing human creativity, a new reading of visionary literature, which would include religious literature as well. As he said, across history, whenever the collective unconscious becomes a living experience and is brought to bear upon the conscious outlook of an age, this event is a creative act which is of importance for a whole epoch. And so, psychological types was Jung's first effort at this sort of a new hermeneutic. A hermeneutics of vision, shall I say. In psychological types, Jung calls history and poetry to evidence of a primordial image playing on the current cultural stage. The confrontation of two primal opposites, call them interior and exterior reality, call them introversion and extroversion, or conscious and unconscious. This is where things stand in the early 20th century. The opposites really are separated. We've divided them. But then Jung extends the discussion in search of some image of unification. In psychological types, he talks about where we are now, the images now in our culture of this separation. But then he starts looking for, is there a way beyond this? And he starts moving back in history, looking at literary figures, looking at forms, looking at voices that spoke of something where the two were unified, joined, a symbol of some sort. And where did he turn? He turned to the Vedas. He turned to Buddhism. He turned to the Tao. Looking in Asian cultures. And then, interestingly enough, he turned back into Christian mysticism, and the principal place he went was a discussion of Meister Eckhart, the great 13th century German mystic, and also heretic in some people's view. And Jung found in Meister Eckhart an experience of the unification of the opposites. And the 18 pages he gives to the discussion of Meister Eckhart in chapter 5 of Psychological Types is really a key to Jung's work and vision. But, I've gotten to this point, but there's one thing he does before he starts talking about Meister Eckhart. He says something about something else, which is extremely important to him, and I'm going to talk about in the last half of our meeting tonight. And that's Gnosticism. He says, before talking about Eckhart, Jung steps back in history even further, to the beginning of the Christian Aeon. And it is in that epoch he identifies the beginning of his own psychology. And you'll notice that throughout Liber Novus there have been a lot of religious themes, God talk. I mean, the stuff he'd been dealing with had a numinous power which had God power. And so he turned back to find the beginnings of his own psychology, actually in a heresy, so-called, of early Christianity, which has been called Gnosticism. And this is what Jung said. And he says this in prelude to trying to understand what Meister Eckhart had been saying in the 13th century. He's looking back 1,000 years before Eckhart, saying, where else is this process of conjoining opposites, of bringing the inner and the outer, the above and the below, the conscious and the unconscious into conjunction in some fashion, where has this been witnessed in history? Where have other people dug into the primordial images of the collective unconscious and found a unification between those images and conscious awareness? Which is really what Jung is looking for in this idea of individuation, of wholeness. It's bringing ourselves into some conjunction with this mysterious psychic force within. This point, mathematical point, which is also all the fixed stars. And so he says of Gnosticism in Psychological Types, and he writes this in 1919, quote, in Gnosticism, we see man's unconscious psychology in full flower, almost perverse in its luxuriance. It contained that Promethean and creative spirit which will bow only to the individual soul and to no collective rule. We find in Gnosticism what was lacking in the centuries that followed, a belief in the efficacy of individual revelation and individual knowledge. This belief was rooted in the proud feeling of man's affinity with the gods, subject to no human law, and so overmastering that it may even subdue the gods by the sheer power of Gnosis. In Gnosis are to be found the beginnings of the path that led to the intuitions of German mysticism, so important psychologically, which came to flower in the Middle Ages. And here he begins his discussion of Meister Eckhart. Now note those words. We find in Gnosticism what was lacking in the centuries that followed. A belief in the efficacy of individual revelation and individual knowledge. Not dogma, not theology. This belief was rooted in the proud feeling of man's affinity with the gods, subject to no human law, and so overmastering that it may even subdue the gods by the sheer power of Gnosis. End quote. So, can you imagine why Dr. Jung might affirm the value of individual revelation, individual knowledge, and vision at this juncture of his life. What's the guy been through? He's been looking for images of others who have shared his experience. He's looked at poets, he's looked at Goethe, he's looked at Nietzsche, he's looked at Spittler, he's looked at Schiller in more current times. And he's seen this image coming out of the collective unconscious of a division, of a duality, seeking union. He's been through this visionary process himself. He's looking for examples. He goes back in history and he finds Meister Eckhart, who actually I think Jung felt that he had some intense personal relationship to, whatever the mystery of history is. He felt something in Meister Eckhart was in him as well, that German mystic of the 13th century. And then he's stepping back and saying, and even 2,000 years ago, there was something like what I have been doing. I find it there too. These are the test cases. These are the historical examples Jung is trying to use to substantiate his new psychology. But what was this gnosis of old? What was it? And that's what we'll get to in the next hour. In summary, and this is a summary I wrote for an Encyclopedia of Psychology and Religion that was published this last summer. C.G. Jung has most frequently been categorized as psychologist and founder of analytic psychology. But Liber Novus, described by its editor as the book that stands at the center of his oeuvre, is distinctly not a clinical or theoretical work of psychology. The word psychologist does not appear in the text even once. If this is the foundation of Jung's life work, or as Jung said, the numinous beginning which contained everything, then his work has, to date, been inadequately contextualized and too narrowly characterized. Between 1913 and 1920, Jung's engagement with imagination and its mythopoetic voice offered to him direct empirical evidence of an apparently autonomous psychoid realm underlying consciousness. Though it was a rare experience, focused engagement and dialogue with this otherwise inherently unconscious dimension opened measureless perspectives on the nature of consciousness itself. While potentially overwhelming and disorienting, the process of accessing and interacting with this realm through functions of dream and fantasy and imagination and vision had a transformative and expansive effect on human consciousness. This Jung witnessed with his own life. Jung's experiment, formally documented in Liber Novus, provided him with a unique perspective on mystical and revelatory religious experience and on the general human propensity for mythic and imaginative expression. The primary hermeneutic task of translating into text and symbolic image his own encounter with mythopoetic imagination subsequently informed his recognition and appreciation of other similar enterprises in history. His extensive writings on mythology and religion, Eastern and Western religious traditions, alchemy, Hermeticism, and Gnosticism, are all influenced by a hermeneutics of human imagination and vision grounded in his own experiences in Liber Novus. End part one. Next up, so who were the Gnostics?